Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If your worst nightmare as a public speaker or presenter is audience boredom, then you haven't heard about the hashtag and Twitter, the undoing of many a public speaker, whether they know it or not, and after the fact. Joining us now to talk about that and how to sweeten those tweets the next time you make a presentation is Deborah Jasper and Betsy Hubbard, co-founders of Mindset Digital. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
Also, Betsy, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So has something fundamentally changed about the public presentation in the digital age?
I think a lot has fundamentally changed. For the first thing, the biggest shift is that there are no captive audiences, and you really see that. So Betsy and I have been traveling around the country. We're the national keynote speakers for KeyBank's Key for Women program, and we're speaking to thousands of women-owned businesses or business owners. And you're seeing, first of all, everyone, you know, if you aren't really deeply engaging, people have other options at their fingertips. So they have phones, they have laptops, there are ways to just tune you out. Right, in real time. But there are also ways, if they don't like you, to take you out. And that is the back channel. So if people don't like what you're doing, they can tweet at the back channel, which is on Twitter. And it's basically, you want to talk about the hashtag a bit?
Sure. On Twitter, there's a convention where if you use a pound sign, or also known as a hashtag, and put a word by it, you know, people can search out those tweets. So you might all be at a conference and you use hashtag, I don't know, ABC12. If you put that in your tweet, then everybody in the room can find the tweets that are originating at that conference or talking about that conference. So you may not know, you know, there may be 600 strangers in a room, but all of a sudden you're linked together in a conversation. That's the back channel. The speakers up front, they're the front channel. You know, they do have the front of the room, but there's very likely a whole conversation going on across the back channel. And it could be good. People could be talking about your points or amplifying your message.
But if they're laughing at
wry,
times when they're not supposed to be laughing,
right,
they're probably laughing at you and not with you.
Chances are good that there's sort of a whole different conversation that they're having.
So we call it two things. So there's back channel, sort of back channel love, where people are going, great, you know, best speaker ever, or that kind of thing. But then there's what you call twekkling, which is heckling, which is, you know, on Twitter, so you're twekkling the speaker. Or we call them harsh tagging if you're saying something harsh about the speaker. So we saw a speaker once in Milwaukee who was just so unpopular that he became a national trending topic on Twitter because everybody was sort of laughing about his speech and all of that. It really is, if you're a public speaker, sort of your worst fear that that's going to happen. So people were tweeting, why are you still on stage? This is like watching the Hindenburg. Someone was tweeting, help, I'm up front and I'm trapped. So there were lots of those kinds of things happening at the back channel. But what we tell speakers is, look, announce the back channel, announce a hashtag, have someone monitor the hashtag while you're speaking, especially if it's a big speech. So as we travel, we take someone with us from Mindset Digital, Jessie Eckert, and she monitors the back channel. So if people have questions for us, she can answer them live. Right now, if people wanted to tweet at hashtag MindsetFF, there's someone who's monitoring that hashtag and, you know, they will answer questions or things like that. So there's a way to turn this to your advantage. People can ask questions. You can see what people are understanding, what they're missing out on. And a lot of times people truly are nice. So people will say, you know, great speakers or that kind of thing. And it gives you a chance afterwards. You can tweet them back and have conversations with your audience.
But it lets them know right off the bat, you know, they know, you know, they know.
Yes, exactly. Hey, we're watching this, so be nice to us. But there are things that you can do to sort of help your speeches along. So if you're developing a presentation today, and I mean, even if you're doing a presentation for your colleagues, not even for hundreds of people, but there are just easy things that make people want to tune in more and make people more open to you. One is, we say templates are evil. So step away from the templates and really try to make your talk more visual.
Do you mean templates meaning like outlines?
Like PowerPoint templates.
Oh, okay.
You know, where you're doing the same thing in every slide.
Okay.
And people get bored easily. So you want to just get rid of that and put in more visual storytelling.
They want to look at pictures.
They want to look at pictures. A lot less text. You know, today's audiences, we have 100,000 words coming at us each and every day, and that's outside of work. So we're looking for, you know, ways that you can engage us in a more visual way. 70% of the information we take in through our eyes. So if you want to get attention, one great way to do it is to be more visual.
Yeah, there's a real problem with putting text on a PowerPoint slide and holding it up in front of people because people have no choice. Really, we cannot prevent ourselves first of all, we're going to look, and if there's words, we're going to read it. Now, you think that's what you want the audience to do, but in a sense, you really don't, because as they're reading it, they are unable to tune into the sound of your voice. What they're really doing is tuning into their own voice, reading aloud in their head. So you are creating, I mean, you're competing with the sound of their own voice in their head, and it makes it very hard for them to follow you as a speaker. So, yeah, you can use text. We put text on some slides, but you really want to simplify it. You want to, you know, don't even think bullet points, just think a couple of words, perhaps. It has to be really easy to take in. And if you are going to use more text on a slide, bring it in one at a time. You know, you can just show the text as you're speaking, because if you give people six bullet points, they're going to read to the end of the slide and then figure out that they have a minute or two until you change slides, and they're going to be off texting, meanwhile, waiting for you to bring up the new slide.
Is PowerPoint the only way to do this, or are there other
Yeah, there
programs?
Are lots of different there ways. Are. We still find PowerPoint, though, is one of the most popular.
It's amazing how it's developed.
It's sort of ubiquitous. But what we say is, look, just because it was developed in the 80s doesn't mean you have to use it as if it's the 80s.
Okay.
So, you know, you can drop the clip art. You can use real photos. You don't have to, you know, those old rules about PowerPoint where you're supposed to have six bullet points and six words per bullet point. Forget that. That is over. In a digital age, you really have to be thinking about that your audience has changed, and so your PowerPoint must change if you're going to continue to get attention. I mean, that's the real challenge.
Can your PowerPoint be too silly?
Yes.
Yes, it can. Yeah. We like to say just because you can doesn't mean you should. I mean, you can go crazy with animation. You can make text flash and, you know, grow bigger and smaller and wave, and you can add sounds. And, you know, the whole point is it is supposed to complement your talk. You know, you're supposed to have such valuable information that what's on the slide is supposed to help enhance that and explain it. If it distracts the audience in any sort of way or detracts from what you're saying, then it really isn't. You know, it's not serving any good purpose. So be careful. Just because you can do really, really fancy things doesn't mean fancy is good. That's not really the message.
Because that can be distracting. And, you know, we caution if just because you can use photos, make sure they're authentic. We say beware of the pretty people. You know, those stock photos, no one really looks like that. And it's the smiling people shaking hands or whatever. I mean, you can't just use photos. You have to use photos that really do convey authentically the points that you're trying to make. Or otherwise people don't see that as real and it doesn't seem very engaging. So there's lots of ways that even as you're moving into a more modern PowerPoint that you still have to be thoughtful about the kinds of content that you're putting up. The biggest thing for people, though, I think, is text. People want to convey everything they know instead of what's most essential to share. And we say, hey, look, your PowerPoint is not a handout. Create a different handout. So if you have, but look, I have to do citations. You know, when I got my PhD and I was presenting in academic conferences, they're expecting you to have citations and to do all kinds of things. You can still hand that out. You just don't want it to be in your presentation. You know, we see people all the time throw up all these links in their PowerPoint. And no matter how hard I try as a member of the audience, I cannot click on the link from your PowerPoint. So it just is distracting. So there's lots of ways to just look at your PowerPoint and think, how do I make this clean and clear and accessible? And how am I sharing just what's most essential?
So you want kind of a variety. You know, you want some static slides or whatever you want to call it. You want a little animation can go a long way. You different colors.
Yeah.
I mean, are there colors that are better than others for background, for instance?
Well,
or do you
change it
up on every slide?
Well,
we do. We change it up.
We tend to change it up. But, you know, some of that comes down to personal preference.
Right.
But, again, it really is. I mean, we have seen slides go up and where people are thinking, I'll make this bright and cheery and I'll use yellow on a white background. That doesn't really work.
Because right. you can't see it.
You can't see it.
Because you can't see it. Yeah.
Right.
So it's great to create visual interest. But, again, the key point is communication. So, you know, is it easy for my audience to take in? That is the point of design. And the more artful you can make it, that's great, but make sure people really get the point.
And, you know, let's talk a moment about sort of the notion with new technologies. You can embed, you know, you're talking about animation, you can embed videos.
Right.
And you should, because the worst mistake you can make, we just spoke at a conference last year in Vegas where you just couldn't get online. The Wi-Fi was down, and you see all these speakers going, and any minute now, it's going to come up, and it's the spiral of death, and everybody's just feeling bad for you. And so we say, don't avoid the web, you know, so embed your videos. Mm-hmm. There's some sites that allow you to do
that. And it takes a little bit of work sometimes, but it's worth it.
Yeah. Oh, it is worth it. It
really
is absolutely
is.
Worth
Here's
it.
Here's what we say. The bar is low for PowerPoint presentations. So if you improve by even 30%, your audience is so grateful. You know, they can really tell the difference and the feedback is amazing.
When you're doing a PowerPoint, should the PowerPoint be driving what you say or should you be saying what the PowerPoint is, what's going to be coming up? I mean, how
yes,
does that
the PowerPoint
work?
What's your should relationship be enhancing with it? What you say. We say dog, see dog. So if you're talking about a dog, your PowerPoint should be showing a dog.
And should it come up a split second after you mention the dog or do you start talking when you see the dog? Because, of course, when you're doing a PowerPoint, you can see everything in front of you. You don't have to be.
Right. You don't have to be relying on the screen. Ideally, right. You want to be in a situation where you do know what's coming. You either know your talk so well or you have, you know, a sight line to see what the next slide is. So you don't need to be turning behind you to see what's coming up. But, yeah, I mean, it you know, some of this is personal preference. Be sure, don't be afraid to pause as a speaker. Bring up a slide, let people register it, go in and talk about it. I mean, sort of more of a simultaneous delivery. But you are driving the talk. They're not here to see your slides. They're here to hear what you have to say. You know, they're in the audience because they want to tune into you. So make it easy for them to tune into you and let the slide support your presentation.
Which is why we say if you are doing a handout, don't do it in advance because what has the audience done? They've read your entire PowerPoint presentation and they've really given themselves permission to, you know, to start texting or to check their email or that kind of thing. Because use curiosity. You know, have people waiting to see what's coming next. And that kind of thing. Don't give people everything up front. And then another thing we say is make sure you're dividing your slides into chapters. You wouldn't read a book without chapters. So you sort of signal to people, here's what's coming. You know, and we're old journalists. And I think the notion for me when we first started doing PowerPoints was, oh, I need a lead. And I need to sprinkle in some gold nuggets, you know, a video here and there, and we right. need something interactive. I mean, they say, and I think these numbers are high, but they say maybe you have 10 minutes where you can speak without doing something. I think it's more like 4. But, you know, you have to do something interactive. You have to ask the audience a question, get them to vote on a video, get them engaged, do something, switch speakers, show videos. So we're doing it really with the you just have to take into account that people have short attention spans. The digital age has changed our expectations. A professor was telling me, I'm mourning the death of the attention span. And that means you have to adjust your PowerPoints accordingly because the moment you step up to speak, studies show people's heart rates are going down. People are literally starting to fall asleep. So you have to do things to keep the engagement up or people will tune you out.
When you talk about interactive and that sort of thing, you're saying vote on videos. What sort of ideas do you have for interactiveness?
Yeah, we do a range of things. So we have a little game we play where people have to guess a tune when we're talking about the curse of knowledge. You know, we try to figure out what are interactive things that really demonstrate our point. So we talk in our presentations about the shift from a mass communications age to a massive communications age. So we show you a video and we say, this is an example of a mass communications age. Describe, you know, watch this video, stand and talk with folks and describe the tone and style of this video, right? And then we show them a different kind of video that's funnier and has a lot more humor and uses this fuzzy meerkat or whatever. And we say, vote on this video. Tell us what you think. Or we'll show them Facebook posts and say, thumbs up, thumbs down. Does this work? So we're always trying to help people engage in the content and vote on it or talk about it or rate it.
Yeah. And the trick is to keep it simple and keep it short. Because, you know, what you don't want to do is divide people into elaborate groups, have them talk for 10 minutes and then report out for 15. I mean, that doesn't work in your average 45-minute presentation. Mm-hmm. But you can easily have people do a thumbs up, thumbs down. Does this work? Does it not? Okay, if it doesn't work, why not? I mean, there's lots of things. Do you like this better or do you like this better? Why? Where you can just get the audience involved. And it's great. I mean, we often will have people stand up. And we've done this in auditoriums. We've done it in flat conference rooms. We've done it in all sorts of environments. Have people stand up and talk to their neighbor for a minute. What do you think the biggest problem is? Somebody asks, you know, then just take three people asking those questions. But the energy, you can just feel it. When you allow people to stand and talk, and you acknowledge that they have ideas too, and you ask them for their ideas, the energy in the room just rises.
Yeah, and here's what we've really found, especially, frankly, if you're giving a presentation to folks and their bosses are in the room, people are just reluctant. Sometimes, you know, they're reluctant to talk, or especially if you're giving a talk in front of 200 to 500 people, you know, fewer people are, well, if you've got 400 people in the room, people are less likely to stand up, right. Especially when you have to give them a mic. But if they talk at their tables and they come up with ideas, more people are willing to stand up and say, well, my table thought. because then it's not just about them. You know, it's about, no, we were having this conversation. So there are ways that it's easier to make people feel more at ease and to get people engaged. Or we'll say, look, here's some aha moments we've experienced with technology. What are yours? And people really, I mean, the energy goes way up. And also, frankly, having people stand, the energy just goes up when you stand. So little tips like that can really change the presentation and change the tone of it.
Well, if anybody wants to see some more tips, they can go to mindsetdigital.com. You have
Click on the blog.
Yep. And you've got some ideas up there. Thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your ideas with us.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks, Ann.
Deborah Jasper and Betsy Hubbard, co-founders of Mindset Digital. Coming up, the ebook and serialized literature. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
College football season is here, and if you're on campus, you know the drill.
People drinking far too much at pregame parties, sneaking alcohol into games, leaving at halftime to go back out to the tailgate to drink even more.
I'm Sarah Gardner. On the next installment of Freakonomics Radio, a look at whether offering booze in the stadium would get fans to drink less. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 77 degrees with cloudy skies. Expect some rain today, possibly a thunderstorm this afternoon, a high of 81. More rain for tonight, a low of 68. Support for 89.7 comes from the Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. Information about how Montgomery & Associates can help you achieve your financial goals can be found online at their website, themontgomerysolution.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The literary serial is nothing new. It started hundreds of years ago, from Dickens to Dostoevsky, and many, many more have done it. How might this literary mode translate in the 21st century, though? Joining us to talk about that is Mark Bryant. He's editor-in-chief of Byliner Digital Publishing Company, which started its serial reading enterprise last week. Mark Bryant is the former editor of Outside, Men's Journal, and Play, the New York Times sports magazine, as well as a former executive editor at HarperCollins. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks, Ann. Thank you very much for having me.
So when did you start thinking about returning to this kind of literary rollout?
Well, we had begun thinking probably one of my co-founders, John Tame, and Byliner's CEO, and I had begun talking about this probably four and a half years ago, about the idea of shorter form storytelling, single stories to start with, stories that were too complex for magazines and too timely or short for conventional books. And we felt that delivering them in an ebook format would be the most practical, cost-effective, kind of convenient thing for readers. However, there were no Kindles really to speak of. There were certainly no iPads, no Nooks, and so forth. And we heard it was all coming. At first, we thought we were perhaps a little too late to the show, and then realized, no, in fact, we're a little too early. Let's hold off. Let's develop things further. And we published our first Byliner original in what is called the Singles, generally referred to generically now as the single space, about a year and a half ago, with John Krakauer's investigation of the philanthropist Craig Mortensen, mm-hmm. in a title called Three Cups of Deceit. We had published, I think, 30-some titles since, by fiction by Amy Tan and Nick Hornby, nonfiction from Ann Passett, Budge Bissinger, Pulitzer Prize-winning civil rights historian Taylor Branch.
And this is all first-time. This is where you go to read it. This isn't a reprint.
No, these are all original commissioned edited works that range generally from 10 to 30,000 words. Sometimes the short stories, some of the short fictions, a little bit shorter than that, but generally kind of novella length. in effect. And I would say from before we published our first nonfiction, John Krakauer's story, mm-hmm. Writers began to say, wow, you know, the delivery vehicle for this could be pretty great. And maybe there's a real possibility for the kind of serialized storytelling that used to flourish, 100 years ago in places like Harper's, mm-hmm. Other magazines. As you said, it began with 1001 Nights. Mm-hmm. Dickens wrote published the Pickwick Papers originally as a serial. Flaubert wrote Madame Bovary, Tolstoy, Anna Karenina, Dostoevsky, the brothers Karamazov. There were less literary things like Sherlock Holmes. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, I think, published it in a magazine called The Strand. More recently, in the 80s, Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities was originally run across, I think, 27 episodes.
Which I did not know until I didn't realize that until I was reading the press release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's we felt like there was a rich tradition, and the idea of delivering these in such a thoroughly modern, really convenient form, we thought held a lot of potential.
My guest, if you're just joining us, Mark Bryant, editor-in-chief of Byliner Digital Publishing Company. We're talking about their new business. There is a special name for this part of the company?
This imprint is called Byliner Serials.
Byliner Serials. If you have a question or comment for Mark, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also tweet us at WOSU. All Sides, or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So how did you know the time was right? How did you know you'd reach that critical mass?
Well, I think we had seen, our projections this year call for us to sell, I think, close to 1.5 million books. We felt like people were really beginning to focus on this space. All the major bookstores now have a storefront within their larger stores devoted to this shorter form storytelling. I believe the numbers were 1 in 3 Americans had some kind of mobile reading device. Mm-hmm. By this coming spring, early this coming spring, the projections are for 1 in 2 Americans to have one of these mobile reading devices of some kind. And so we felt like there was a lot more attention being paid to this format and this kind of delivery system for things. And that therefore, given the interest among writers as well, the timing seemed to be nice. Margaret Atwood published a wonderfully dystopian story called I'm Starred for You with us in March. And we published it in our Byliner Fiction imprint. And she received such an incredible response to it from her readers that she said, you know, it might be fun to extend this out, see these characters through, you know, many episodes.
Mm-hmm. Did she propose that to you, or did you propose that to her? I was wondering how you got someone like Margaret Atwood, who's phenomenal, to do this kind of thing.
Well, it originally came through our marvelous fiction editor, Amy Grace Lloyd, who is friends with Margaret, and Margaret was very interested from the get-go in experimenting with the kind of work that we're doing, mm-hmm. in this kind of space, and wanted to support. She's been, I believe Margaret is 72, but you wouldn't know it.
I mean,
she's so thoroughly engaged in all things digital and really embraces the possibilities in this. That she and Amy got to talking about publishing on Star for You once we did, and she saw it sort of take off. Then she came back and, as I understand it, proposed this serial for us. So we're thrilled to have it. She will write several episodes, and then we will. She will probably then perhaps extend it even further into a full-length conventional book.
Yeah, eventually you put it all together and you have a book, mm-hmm. instead of a series of short stories. How do you time the rollouts? I was wondering if she had written everything in advance and then you're rolling it out, or is she writing it while people are reading the previous
episode? That's a great question, Ann. She, in her case, she is writing it as we wait for them, as we the readers wait for them. She is sorting through the narrative arc as we go. I think the we've come to think of these Byliner serial stories as a little more as one would think about a television series. It's based, you're not delivering so quickly that it's all about plot. When something's really plot driven, I think you want the next payoff pretty quickly.
Right.
In this case, yes, each story leaves you has a nice beginning, middle, and end, but also, you know, there's a bit of a cliffhanger at the end of each one of these. And I think what you're more interested in than plot is character. You really want to see these characters through. And if they're really richly drawn characters, great portraits of these people you're made to care about, then I think it has, you know, then serialization, I think, relax.
I was wondering if certain authors might not necessarily, their usual style might not lend itself to this. Maybe a Stephen King, who is very plot driven.
Well, I
on the other hand, he's done some great short stories, and
really
I can
have.
See
yeah.
I can see those weaving those together in
exactly.
that style. Yeah,
exactly. I think Stephen King would be quite capable of.
Of doing
of
whatever you want him to do.
Form. Exactly. and we're, you know, as I said, this is an experiment. I mean, you know, we'll see what types of storytelling works best, what seems to be, you know, received, you know, to the fullest extent, I guess. We're also publishing, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but we're also publishing nonfiction in the serialized form. Joe McGinnis, great true crime nonfiction master is writing something, publishing something with us called 15 Gothic Street, which is the story of life in and out of an American courthouse over the course of a typical year. So we're very interested in seeing how that plays out as well. The first episode of that was published last week as well.
Mark Bryant, who's the audience? You said you've sold 1.5 million books.
We anticipate this year coming.
This year, get reaching 1.5 million. Who's buying this experiment so far?
Well, the experiment just launched last week.
Okay.
The Byliner serials. What we're finding at Byliner is that it's a real range of people, just smart people who enjoy, smart, curious people who enjoy reading, who like a form that is often too long and complex for the ever-shrinking space in a magazine, in a traditional magazine,
right?
And yet don't necessarily always have the time to sit down and read a full-length book. Those kind of deeper explorations seem to be very, you know, very well received. Essentially, we talk about publishing stories that can be read in a single sitting.
You okay.
Know, two or three hours.
That's kind of the definition of the product.
That's the definition of the product, exactly.
And the difference between what you've already gotten into before and what you launched last week is the serialization.
Exactly.
Okay.
Serializing story, each installment or episode is essentially the length of what one would call a single.
What's the cost of this? How is it? How are you pricing it? Or is that part of the experiment, too?
Well, that'll be part of the experiment. Mm-hmm. But right now, we're publishing them much as we do our other stories, which are generally $2.99.
Mm-hmm.
Joe McGinnis's stories, each of his installments will be $2.99. Each of Margaret Atwood's will be $2.99. if an author doesn't have quite the built-in audience of a writer with the renown of someone like Margaret Atwood, we'll sometimes publish things a little bit lower at $1.99. But we tend to think that great writing should have some real value.
I was going to ask you, is this an opportunity to launch writers that you might not be able to do in the full book form with paper and hardcover, but you can launch them this way through the ebooks? I know lots of independent people mm-hmm. out there just self-publishing in that way, but
right, and some of them very successfully,
mm-hmm.
as you know. It will be an interesting opportunity. Each one of our imprints we have so far launched with major authors. And then after a certain amount of time, we've tried to work in lesser known or even altogether unpublished authors up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to see if the serialization idea works with lesser known authors. I think that's something that we'll have to find out as we go along. We did publish an author last fall with a woman who had a remarkable memoir. Wrote us a brief pitch. She was 26 years old. Her name is Rachel Corbett. She just finished her MFA at Columbia and wrote us a very interesting proposal about a murder-suicide that had been committed in a part of rural Iowa where she had grown up. And this had happened, the incident had happened when she was 8 years old. It had been committed by a man who, until shortly before this, had been her mother's longtime boyfriend, and she had felt quite close to him. And she was going back at the age of 26 to kind of figure out what had happened. And I thought, you know, this is an incredibly haunting story. Let's assign it. Let's see if we can break out an author, kind of fit them into the slipstream behind these bigger names and see if, you know, Byliner has enough of a quote-unquote brand to help launch someone.
Mm-hmm.
Piece came in. We thought it was really terrific. I said, you know, it's so unrelievedly sad, it won't sell, but, you know, we should be doing this anyway. And very happily, I was completely wrong. She was, the story is called A Murder in Iowa, and it was for 2 or 3 months in the Kindle single store on their bestseller list, their top 10, trading spaces off and on through the course of many weeks with Stephen King, completely unknown author, essentially an unpublished author. So it did demonstrate that if you have the right story, you really can break out.
Do you do the same sort of editing that a regular publisher would? I mean, do you work with the writers?
We do. We're very old-fashioned editors in that sense. Many authors complain about the lack of editing they get with book publishers, traditional book publishers, who are really much more focused on acquisition than the actual editing and publishing. That's really where I think we're at our best, is working, helping an author conceptualize a story, a narrative, working with them through the course of the line edit, and so on.
I looked, and I could not figure out if anybody else is doing this.
There aren't many people who are doing it. Amazon's own publishes some of their own stories.
Right, but in a serialization?
No, not in serialization.
Exactly.
We're the only ones.
Okay.
That I'm aware of. In terms of this shorter form, this single space, there are a few other people experimenting with it as well. But serials, I think we're the first into that.
Well, thanks for talking with us about it today.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Talking with Mark Bryant. He's editor-in-chief of Byliner Digital Publishing Company. We've been talking about their new Byliner Serial. Coming up, we're going to talk about apps, music apps today. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Join 89.7 NPR News and WOSU-TV for live coverage of the Democratic National Convention. Tonight, WOSU Public Media brings you the latest from NPR and PBS. That's special coverage live from Charlotte tonight at 8 on 89.7 NPR News, WOSU-TV, and at WOSU.org/campaign2012. 77 degrees in downtown Columbus. Rain today, maybe a thunderstorm, a high of 81. A chance of showers tonight, a low of 68 degrees. Fog Wednesday morning, sunshine in the afternoon, a high of 88. Support for 89.7 comes from the United Way of Central Ohio. United Way is working to improve lives and strengthen our community by bringing people together and organizations to address local issues in education, income, health, and home. More information on how to get involved is at liveunitedcentralohio.org. And support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movements in our community. More information on the fall edition, coming September 15th, can be found at ediblecolumbus.com. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
If you want to comb your cat, there's an app for that. If you have to fix a flat, there's an app for that. Need a word that rhymes with that?
Mat, rat, rat, rat.
Or a place to hang your hat? Got a chimp who likes to chat. There's an app for that.
Sesame Street, once again, staying up with the times. If you've heard about the digital music revolution, the revolution inside that revolution, or the second big development in the digital music world is the app. Joining us now to talk about music-related apps and their place in the future of music is Dan Rockwell, Program Manager of the Software Prototyping Center at the OSU Technology Commercialization and Knowledge Transfer Office. Dan has more than 11 years of design experience working with Fortune 500 companies, and before joining OSU, he founded Big Kitty Labs to mentor and build rapid prototypes for startups. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, what's going on, Ann?
I think we found your new theme music.
That is a pretty wild intro for me, I have to say.
Good old Sesame Street. So before we get into specifics, Give us a broad brush stroke of how apps are evolving or changing the digital music world. What's the universe out there?
The universe for music apps is pretty massive and crazy. I think it's one of the most exciting areas of the iPhone itself. I'm not really a great musician, but I like to hack and mix around with stuff. But basically, on music apps, you know, you have sort of two big buckets. The first big bucket is sort of the Spotify, the iTunes, Turntable FM, sort of how you listen to music. And then the second big bucket is making music. And so a lot of people are really going to the iPhone, and there's 15,000 music apps. I read that online last night. I was like, wow, this is a ton. Mm-hmm. And it's really a whole bunch of categories. So you have instruments, you have generators, you have samplers, you have synths, you've got beatboxes, DJ apps, effect apps, soundboards, everything that you would see in traditional music scene now, right? Any instrument has basically been recreated into an iPhone app at some point. And then there's lots of things that sort of augment and affect sounds and organize sounds once you get on that. And what you find is that people are actually using apps to actually play music in bands and actually making things and actually really sort of not only making the apps, but making music with them and actually entertaining, you know, people with them.
So can you combine apps, or do you apply different apps at different points in the process? Say you want to put together a band and you've got, I mean, are there apps that have all the instruments you need, or are there apps that just, do they just dish it up one instrument at a time?
Yeah, there's actually both. You can find apps that actually have all the different instruments in them, or you can find apps in their standalone that you kind of like the way they, you know, organize a sampler, or the way they play a synth, or the way they, you know, play an accordion sound or whatnot. So it really depends, and that's kind of the addictive part of music apps, is that you don't just get three or four. You end up with like 90, like me. I got like 90 music apps. It's because you're constantly finding something new to tweak with.
You become an app hoarder.
Yes, I am an app hoarder, and I'll go ahead and admit that on the radio. But I think that's okay, because there's a lot of other benefits from music apps as well. Is that if you're ever curious about mobile app design, music apps are great apps to study, because they really try to be pretty creative with the user, and so they use lots of really different kinds of interfaces to get people to be creative.
Like what?
Well, just they're not the standard sort of interface that you see in if you look at most social media apps, they have the same flow. You got a top nav, you got a bottom nav, and something happens in between, right? You click back and forth. Music apps are really wildly creative. They're just all over the map. They have different types of gestures. They have different ways that they try to get you to interact with them to create sounds. And that's really sort of a fun playground to go and see how people are going to make that music app, you know, come together. So it's a really great place for inspiration.
So when it comes to the creation apps first, we might as well just keep talking about those. Who's making them? Do they tend to be musicians, or do they tend to be app developers like the people you talk to?
Sure.
The Software Prototyping Center?
Well, yeah, they're from usually app developers who are already focused on music apps, either app developers, you even see large name brands in music. Say, for example, Korg. Korg is a big name in music. They make keyboards, they make synthesizers, they make samplers. They're a real strong force in the App Store. They have about probably three or four major iPhone apps and iPad apps, and they're huge. They're hugely popular. They put tons of capability, and they cram it all that down into an iPhone app, and they sell it at, you know, a fourth or, you know, just a, I don't know, 1/100th of the price of a normal sampler or whatever. They make things really, because, you know, you don't see apps in the App Store for hundreds of dollars. You see them for $1.99 or maybe $30 at that. So you see a lot of the major manufacturers are building iPhone apps because they know their consumers are there. They know that their users are hanging out and using iPhone to make sound, so they want to be found as well. And then you also see a lot of people who, again, they're an app developer. They want to experiment in that space. It's a great place to go and build a music app and sell it because there's a growing, you know, base of users who are really hungry to use these apps to play with and make sounds.
My guest is Dan Rockwell. He manages the Software Prototyping Center at OSU's Technology Commercialization and Knowledge Transfer Office. We're talking about music apps today. If you have a question or comment, if you have a favorite music app that you want to share with us, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can tweet us at WOSU and All Sides, WOSU All Sides, or you can go to our Facebook page. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So when you make, you create a song, you make music with an app.
Yep.
The quality, I mean, is this just something you post on? Where do you post it? Who? How do you get people to listen to it? And what's the quality of it?
The quality is pretty decent. I mean, you're gonna run your phone through a mixer most likely, or record it right into your computer, and the sound is actually very decent. You can actually post a lot of good songs that you make or any sound you make to some popular services. For example, SoundCloud. It's probably the premier sort of audio social network out there in terms of getting music online and sharing music online. You can share it on Facebook and Twitter and therefore other places, which is really popular. I really don't know too many other great places to sort of share music other than SoundCloud. They sort of, that's a good startup to invest in there.
You know, it reminds me of that. I think it was when Moog, you know, Moog synthesizer.
Yeah.
I don't think it was the birthday of that. And Google on its Google title, on its title page, what do you want to call it?
Oh, yeah.
Turned each letter into a sound,
yeah,
like a synthesizer, and I played with that thing all day.
I had some friends actually make tracks on that.
You could record it.
Yeah, you could record it, and then they would go and they would record it to the computer. And that's what you sort of see is you see a lot of people hacking with music, and that's the most rewarding part of it is that you don't necessarily have to know anything about music to play music, and that's the really freedom that comes with the iPhone and the iPad is that. And in some ways, you know, a lot of people say, like, well, you can't even read music. You shouldn't have any business playing music. I'm like, this is just fun. This is creativity here. I just want to, you know, just get lost a little bit in a couple of music apps. And I think that's what's happening. And that's why you're seeing so many people not only buy the apps, but you're seeing a lot of people emerging as iPad and iPhone, you know, based bands where all the team members are all playing an instrument and they're all on their mobile devices.
Wait a minute. They're doing it all at the same time together?
Yeah, they do. I have a band like that here in town myself. I have a friend who has two iPads. He plays two iPads and an iPod Touch. I play an iPad and an iPhone, and I play a couple other sort of the controllers and sort of devices. And so it's all sort of electro music, you know, ambient type band called Circuitry Room. We play here in town a couple times. But it's fun. I mean, that's why not? You know, you can play, you can be creative, then go for it.
When you say we play here in town, what do you mean by that?
Well, we play here locally. See you to the next one.
Where do I go to hear it?
Well, you know, I'm not playing at the Newport, right?
Right.
I usually work with a lot of different art, you know, sort of art organizations in town. The Fuse Factory is one of the groups in town, which does a lot of sort of these alternative type music affairs. They have something called Frequency Fridays, where they get local bands to sort of get together in at different venues, such as the Wild Goose Creative,
uh-huh,
or a couple other venues here in town. And you basically, you know, you get on the stage, and you know, it's a different kind of band, right? And the you know, 10 years ago, you'd break out your guitar, right? Well, now you're breaking out your iPad.
I know, you're just sitting there doodling on your iPad.
Yeah, you're jamming, and you're doing. And I would say that some of them are more structured. We tend to be sort of a improv band, so we don't know what song is going to come out. We're just going to hook up our devices and just jam, and that's fun. And crazy, but fun.
I'm interested. I'm going to check it out. Dan Rockwell, he's program manager for Software Prototyping Center at OSU. Let's move from the creative end of it to the other side of it, the other bucket, the Spotify's and the iTunes. What's that like out there now?
Well, you know, I think, you know, Spotify has really sort of taken, I'd say, the U.S. market by storm. They're definitely a very popular app.
Tell how that works.
Well, you know, Spotify is sort of sharing your playlist with other users, right? So you're sharing your tracks and playlists from your own sort of iTunes collection with other users. And, you know, those apps, I'm still trying to figure out exactly how they make money in different ways, but they're definitely popular. And everybody likes free music. You know, everyone likes to sort of download either podcasts full of songs or to be able to hear other songs from other folks. Turntable FM is another, probably one of the more popular apps that's come out in the last year, where basically people are taking turns DJing a whole set of music that plays, you know, on and on and on while people hang out in the chat room and talk and have conversation. You know, music apps are always going to be popular because people want to basically flaunt their music. They want to listen to a song and then also share their song. There's apps like out there like Soundtracker, which allows you to sort of listen to a song and then also share it as almost like a tweet or Facebook update and saying, this is what I'm listening to right now, which is sort of showing your status around your own music and your sound. So I think that's a growing category. I don't think it's growing as much as making music because it's sort of a, there's only so many different ways you can sort of invent the iTunes, you know, player, right? You're going to listen to music. Okay. Done, you know. You know, it's got Spotify and there's iTunes, and I think RDO is another one that's in the space, and that's about it, other than the Turntable FMs and a couple other places.
Well, what about the ones that sort of riff off of that? Like, there's Spotify. It scours the web for new music and correlates it with Spotify.
Yeah. Spotify sort of does that. I mean, but it's doing it in a more organized. It's got to be focused on.
I guess it's Spotify is what it's how it's pronounced.
Spotify. Yeah. You've stumped me. I can't believe it. And on an app I'm not aware of. Darn it.
I have a whole list of laps here. I mean, apps here. Pandora. It reminded me of Pandora, where you pick a song you like, and then it just starts playing songs that thinks you like.
Pandora. You know, it's like weird. You know, like all technology. You go through a phase of like, wow, that's awesome. And then, you know, after like a year, you're like, what was that thing I really liked?
I don't like the ads on it, but
yeah,
they got to make money somehow, I suppose.
True,
and it's free.
That's true. I do like Pandora a lot because you can put all your sort of key interests or you like certain songs and then goes off and find other songs. And they just got to profitability, so I'm excited for them.
What's that?
They're finally profitable, I think, is what I read recently.
Oh, okay, so they'll survive.
Yeah, hopefully they'll survive.
There's other sorts of things like Songkick. Have you heard of that?
I have heard of Songkick. I don't think I've messed with that one yet.
The tour box feature lets bands automate the publication of their tour dates.
There are a lot of apps. One of the new emergence of apps is Local Sound. So it'll just play music from local artists in town. Which I think is interesting. So there's a couple apps around that.
So you put in your location and it.
Yeah, it says here's all the local sort of music happening in your area. Canon FM is one of the concepts here in Columbus. It's like that to start up. A couple other players in that space. And I think that's, again, if you have a strong community in your town that loves local music, those apps will survive. I think if not so much, then they just don't resonate so much. Like, you know, Austin, and I think Columbus has a really good local music scene. Austin obviously has a really big local music scene. Portland, those are the places where those apps are really going to flourish because people want to find out sort of what's playing locally and listen before they go out to the gig in some cases.
Then there's the Share My Playlist. Well, that's kind of like Spotify. There's Groove Shark's Beluga.
Groove Shark is a great web. I've seen that as a web app. I haven't seen the actual iPhone app. Now, what's nice about Groove Shark on the web is you can type in any artist. It's sort of like an online Napster. You know, it's just like you just go ahead and suck down a lot of illegal tracks. But I think they are trying to figure out ways to get more legit.
We have a tweet from Jason. He writes, have you heard of the app Pocket Hipster? I just like the name.
I do like the name a lot. I don't know what that app is offhand, but I'm writing that down. Thank you, Jason. I'm going to check out Pocket Hipster.
Pocket Hipster.
Yeah.
Okay, Jason, we'll keep you posted. Email from a listener. I have found music-related apps being pushed at me more and more. I think some musicians are making their own apps. So instead of reading the notes that used to come with a CD, you can get an app from your favorite artist for $3.99 or something. I know Jay-Z is doing this.
Yeah, actually, that's a big trend happening with a lot. In fact, some music artists are actually giving an app where you can remix the song, some of their top, some of their big songs in the app, which is pretty cool if you think about it, because you're actually getting the actual different sound bites and allows the actual fan to be more creative with that song. You can remix it some other way you want. What's fun about those apps is that you can actually use them in your own sets. So, like, when you get together with your friends and you're playing a music set, you can actually, use a sample from somebody else's musical artist, whatever, into your own pieces, which is kind of fun.
And as far as the music notes go, that's something I like about Pandora, too. You can read about the music.
Music notes, and then, of course, just the literal notion of music notes. There's actually a lot of
There's
a lot of iPad apps that are big on actual teaching people how to read music and looking at the actual musical notes on that, too. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, that's, CDs, we used to look at case, right? We used to look at all the notes and information and whatnot. We don't really see that anymore, or at least I'm sure it's probably still happening, but I don't know who's buying CDs.
I know, isn't that funny? Haha, but, just a couple of years ago.
I know, isn't that crazy? There's a whole giant industry that's, like, gone.
Hey, what about for kids? Are there any music apps for kids that might, you're talking about apps that teach you to read music. Any thoughts about that or not yet?
The most popular apps for kids are the soundboard apps. The soundboard apps from their favorite TV shows like Sesame Street or whatever, where they have, like all the sound samples from, like Elmo or something like that, and they go through and they play all the different sound samples or whatnot. Those apps are, they're not really educational, but they're just sort of fun to screw around with. But I'd say that education-wise, there's a lot of educational musical apps for sure. Education apps are, that's a huge field in itself. That's another show, and we have to do that one.
We will be doing that. And we'll make sure that we call you Dan Rockwell. Thank you so much for joining us today. Dan Rockwell, we've still got to work on the title for him, but he's program manager of the Software Prototyping Center at the OSU Technology Commercialization and Knowledge Transfer Office. So once again, Dan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to the All Sides crew. Hope you enjoyed your vacation. The All Sides staff includes associate producer Amy Jurovich, All Sides assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, All Sides production assistants Katie Higgins and Leticia Wiggins, All Sides volunteer Rose Joe. Also, Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French, with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.